Are you afraid to take a shower behind a translucent curtain? Unable to escape the image of a crazed killer with a butcher's knife? Or perhaps you worry about the mysterious plain van slowly patrolling your neighborhood, looking for what exactly? Many of us only know psychopathy through fiction and pop culture, and the history of psychopathic killers is quite real. The good news is that most psychopaths are not killers. The bad news is that psychopathy is probably more malevolent and prevalent than you would imagine. The psychopath test, next on Monster Talk.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Ben Radford and Karen Stolzner, we talk about monsters, myths, and science fact. Today's topic is one that we will be visiting again. Our guest is John Ronson, whose book, The Psychopath Test, just came out in paperback. It's a fun read about a very unfun topic. Psychopaths are, in some respects, quite like pod people from Invasion of the Body Snatchers. They look like you and me. They act like you and me, but inside, they can be quite alien. Of course, most psychopaths are not serial killers or child molesters, but they quite simply don't have the same emotional underpinnings as most humans, and therefore no internal punishment system to prevent bad behavior. They feel no remorse, they feel no guilt, and some of them even doubt such feelings exist in everyone else, having never experienced such things themselves. This episode of Monster Talk will not protect you from psychopaths. It won't tell you how to avoid being manipulated by them or deceived. But it does give you an overview of both psychopathy and a bit of info on Ronson's book, which of course goes into much more detail. The psychopath test isn't just a story about identifying such people. It's also a story about the abuse that can happen when people believe that they have a foolproof method for such identification. For you see, there's no cure for psychopathy. And once you're so labeled, it could be nearly impossible to get rid of that label if it's been misapplied.
Monster Talk.
Okay, today we're going to talk to John Ronson about his... this is your most recent book, right?
Yes.
Okay, so this is The Psychopath Test. It's now coming out in paperback. But you're also... our listeners may know you from The Men Who Stare at Goats, or Them, or any number of really cool British documentaries. So that's nice. But how did you come to write about psychopaths?
Gosh, I tell you what it was. I met a woman who married a guy internet dating, and he was a very gallant man. He would always walk on the roadside of the pavement, for instance, which I didn't even realize was a gallant thing to do. That's how ungallant I am. And, you know, he was very suave, and she married him, and he told her that he worked for the CIA. So he'd go off for months on end to Jenin, Palestine, and she'd get these texts from the CIA, like protected texts, saying he's okay, he's fine, he's been injured, but he's fine. And this went on for about 8 years. And then she discovered that he wasn't in the CIA at all. He was a fraudster and a bigamist. And when he was in Jenin, he was actually at his other family's house just down the road. So two things came from this story that just stayed with me. One was, I said to Mary, so do you feel hurt by it all? And she said, well, no, because does the wildebeest feel hurt when it's being chased by the lion? No, the wildebeest knows it's not personal, and he's a psychopath, and it's not personal. So I thought that was an extraordinary thing to say about a human being. And also, I spoke to a psychologist named Martha Stout, who said that the condition that this guy suffers from is the condition that effectively rules the world, that psychopathy is so powerful it's remolded society or wrong. And that reminded me of David Icke, who I wrote about in my book, Them. And David Icke said that giant blood-drinking, paedophile, child-sacrificing lizards secretly rule the world. And, of course, nobody paid David Icke much heed. Everyone was paying Martha Stout heed. She's a Harvard psychologist, and it was basically the same theory. This race of people that aren't quite human are secretly ruling the world. So these were just big questions, and they were the questions that led me to write the book.
I think it's funny you said he suffers from psychopathy, but isn't he doesn't?
Psychopathy is the most pleasant feeling of all the mental disorders. There's no suffering at all, because the amygdala, which is the thing that basically provides a lot of our suffering, guilt and remorse and anxiety, underperforms in people who are called psychopaths. So you're absolutely right, zero suffering.
John, what makes someone a psychopath, and is it a clinical term as well?
Right now in the DSM, the term is APD, antisocial personality disorder. The word psychopath really belongs to a man named Robert Hare, who invented the checklist, the Hare PCLR checklist, which is like the gold standard for diagnosing the condition. When you look at definitions of sociopathy or psychopathy or APD, it's the same thing. So it is a clinical thing. But unfortunately, it's very hard to spot in people. It's malevolent and it's hard to spot. And so Hare came up with this 20-point checklist of sort of nuances of behavior that if you're qualified in the checklist, you can learn to spot them. You can learn to root them out even when they're pretending to be normal by their linguistics, their turns of phrase and so on, which struck me again as a sort of huge thought. Isn't that open to terrible abuse? So I decided to become a psychopath spotter, and indeed immediately started abusing my power.
as one might expect you would have, with achieving this newfound power. I was curious about in your book, obviously in your new book, you're exploring psychopaths, although in your previous books, particularly Them, I think, you've obviously spoken with, you talked about David Icke before, and others as well. I'm wondering whether, in light of your new research and your new book, if there are people that you interviewed previously for your other books or for your articles or anything else that you are now either more or less concerned about, having more experience and insight into psychopaths, maybe people who you said, well, actually, they seem to be fine, or really, oh my God, I'm surprised she didn't rip my eyes out and eat them.
Right. Well, I certainly have one or two suspects in mind from previous books. There's one person I can think of in the Many Stoic Goats. Everybody else in the Many Stoic Goats, I think, no way are they in any way psychopathic. In Them, it sounds sort of funny because Them is populated with white separatists and white supremacists and hardcore conspiracy theorists and Alex Jones. And in Them, I can't really think of anyone who would strike me, obviously, as a psychopath. We can talk about that some more if you like. I can think of, there's somebody who I interviewed one time, and I don't want to name him because he would probably sue me, and he's such a bastard, he'd probably pursue me to the ends of the earth.
Psychopath.
Well, yeah, and so consequently would just take enormous pleasure from doing it. So I won't name him, but I can certainly think of one person who I've encountered over the years who there's no question in my mind is psychopathic, and there's another person I've just thought of who I would suspect, but I feel bad about sort of just labeling like some kind of gun for hire, like just labeling people with such a huge phrase. I mean, for a while I sort of wondered. No, I can't say. I mean, I'd love to say, but I just feel like I can't. Well, this is what I will say, that some people may disagree with what I'm about to say, but if you're an ideologue, if you believe in something bigger than yourself, doesn't that mean that you're not psychopathic, because psychopathy is a very, very selfish thing. It's all about boosting yourself in society at the cost of everybody else. So if you're a genuine ideologue, if you're Omar Bakri Muhammad or David Icke or people who seem to really, really believe what they say, that sort of negates the idea that they're psychopathic, I think. As I say, some people might disagree with that, but that feels logical to me.
They're delusional instead or something else.
Not even yes, absolutely. With David Icke, it's very hard to work him out, very hard.
Well, it seems like it would be tricky, though, to distinguish between someone who's a true ideologue and someone who's using that sort of ideology to fulfill their own personal power goals. Like certain religious leaders come to mind where it turns out that, they're actually quite selfish or doing things against their religious creeds behind the scenes while espousing certain values.
Most certainly. That's the giveaway. Unquestionably, yeah. Definitely. Because, one of the items on the checklist is cunning, manipulative. Another item is callous lack of empathy and all these things that would say, you would use religion as a way of kind of cloaking your true intentions.
Gotcha. So can you just tell us a little bit? I mean, I would like people to actually read the book, but what is the psychopath test itself? What does that actually entail doing?
So it's this 20-point checklist, which I learned over 3 days in a marquee in West Wales with Robert Hare, who's the king of psychopath spotting. And as I say, unlike a lot of disorders, the diagnosee isn't usually invited to take part in their own diagnosis, because if they're psychopaths, it means they'll manipulate the test. So they're diagnosed from afar more often than not. And it's basically through studying the way they respond to certain questions. So I'll give you one example from my book. I went to meet a man named Toto Constant, who was a Haitian death squad leader. I met him in prison in upstate New York, where he's serving 12 to 37 years for mortgage fraud. So not only was he a death squad leader, he was also a mortgage fraudster, which is item 20 on the checklist, criminal versatility. So I went to see him. And he kept saying to me, I just want people to like me. It's really important that people like me. And after a while, I said to him, isn't that a weakness, just desperately wanting someone to like you? And he said, no, it's not a weakness, and I'll tell you why. If you can get people to like you, you can manipulate them to do whatever you want them to do. So straight out of the checklist. And it proves. I came away from this with no doubt in my mind that the Hare checklist is accurate, but I have huge doubts about the way that it's used in society.
So if APD is a clinical disorder, is there some kind of treatment for this?
No treatment. This is a kind of nihilistic story. Well, I say no treatment, but I'm going to caveat that in a sec. The majority of people who work with people with APD or psychopathy or whatever you want to call it will say no. They only stop being malevolent when they just get too old and lazy to get up off the sofa. So it's a kind of dark story. So for instance, I was in Stockholm last week and I met somebody who works with psychopaths, and he said reoffenders who aren't psychopathic tend to stop around the age of 50, but reoffenders who are psychopathic tend to just carry on until they literally can't crawl out the door. Saying that, there's other people who will say that there's some evidence that cognitive behavioral therapy can work if you can convince the person that it's in their own best interests to change. And there are units that, in Britain and America that try that out. Also, since my book came out, obviously I've had huge amounts of correspondence with everybody from psychopaths to people who believe that their wife or husband or boss or father is a psychopath, to people who believe it almost certainly wrongly. And I've had a couple of emails from people who say, I am a psychopath, I've been diagnosed a psychopath, it's no question, I'm definitely a psychopath, and I'm sick of it. I'm sick of just leaving a kind of trail of malevolence in my wake, and I want to change. I want to use my psychopathy for good. And one of them said, I want to use it to become a better church missionary. And another one said, I want to use it to become a better salesman. And you know what? Well, on both of those occasions, I believed them.
And I'm just wondering, where do you draw the line between mental illness and some kind of ethical or moral position that they have, or lack thereof?
Yeah, well, it's not a mental illness. It's you know, mental illness is defined pretty much when you have, you know, hallucinations or delusions or you know, things that can be helped with medication. And psychopathy is probably better described as a moral deficiency, because there's no empathy, because that part of the brain underperforms. There's no real morality. It's just a sort of, you know, a sort of field of dead crops where empathy and remorse and guilt should be.
Wow.
Yeah. Everything I'm saying here is kind of difficult for me to say, because it goes against all my liberal sensibilities, you know, because I'm raised to believe, and basically do believe, that everyone's basically the same. You know, everyone's basically just like me. So, yeah, empathetic and wanting to do good and wanting to be a good person. But, yeah, the evidence is that, you know, there's 1 in 100 of us who actually aren't just like us. They're completely different. But you can see that everything that I'm saying is open to, like, real abuse, because if you start thinking of these people as, like, not quite human, yeah, imagine the things you can justify yourself doing to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was actually, it's interesting, in a couple places in your book and also in your earlier book, then I found what seemed to be some slightly surprising statements. For example, you said that, he says, I'd always believed society to be a fundamentally rational thing. And I'm wondering, is this true, or is this just a journalistic conceit? I mean, you really did believe that society was fundamentally rational?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I don't mean that in an insulting way. I'm just kind of surprised.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, I guess. I mean, obviously, I know there's an awful lot of irrational people in the world, and I know that, you know, irrationality quite often drives me. It's a more powerful engine in my life than rationality. But, you know, what popped into my head when you asked me that was my father, you know, saying to me, I remember, like, 1979 or 1978, if Margaret Thatcher gets into power, I'll take us all out for dinner. You know, my father was a conservative small businessman who believed that our leaders, our political leaders, were rational beings, and I guess I came up with a similar, you know, I was influenced by that, and I don't believe it anymore, but I did believe it.
And you certainly hadn't been through the experience of George W. Bush, otherwise that would be crystal clear that certainly, yeah, our rational is not quite the same.
Yeah, unquestionably, and but I always kind of saw that stuff, you know, as the exception that proves the rule. Although, of course, I don't live in a country that's, you know, how many people believe in God in America? It's like 80% or 90% or something.
Something like that.
Yeah, so obviously I don't come from a country like that, so it's probably easy to...
Fair point.
Yeah.
And next on Philosophy Talk... I mean, I do understand, like, you know, I mean, to say it's I don't want to get off on a tangent, but there is the whole thing about Thomas Hobbes and the social contract. And even in the most dysfunctional societies, you'd have to suspect that there is some rational basis for allowing a government to exist, which protects the people. It's just that the flavors of protection can range from, you know, some sort of almost anarchy to fascism. I don't, you know, so, yeah.
Sure, absolutely. And it's... And just the sort of idea that, you know, people rise up the ladder on the basis of merit. I mean, as I say, obviously now I'm in my 40s and I can see the world much more for what it is now. But, you know, growing up in a sort of suburban house in Wales, I just kind of believed that. I just believed that, you know, that the further you go up the ladder, the more rational. And we were the crazy ones going around down below. I mean, obviously that's clearly not true, but it's certainly what I believe.
let's get back onto psychopathy and more specifically the role of psychopaths in monster lore. Well, let me ask it this way. Did doing this research change your opinion on the image of psychopathy in popular culture?
Yeah, well, Hare said to me almost at the very beginning, he said, you know, there are no accurate portrayals of psychopaths in the movies. And then he caveated that by saying that actually there is one. And when he told me who it was, I thought, oh, you know, you're absolutely right. And it's the Sissy Spacek character in Badlands, Holly. You know, the way that she, if anybody listening to this hasn't seen Badlands, you've got to go and see it anyway, because it's, you know, one of the greatest movies ever. But what she really displays is one of the items on the checklist, which is shallow affect, an inability to experience a range of emotions. And so you ape other people's emotions. Toto Constant, the Haitian death squad leader, at one point pretended to cry in front of me. And it was just obviously pretending to cry. It wasn't real. And in Badlands, Holly's entire voiceover is like cliched statements that she had read in some movie magazines. And so that's a kind of beautifully drawn portrayal of somebody who has this condition. But yeah, certainly people like Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, that's much too kind of baroque to be true. They're not that. Their charisma is superficial. That's another really interesting thing about them, is that they're not massively charismatic. They're ostensibly charismatic, and the more time you spend with them, the more you realize that the charisma is like a sort of, it's like a front, it's like a sort of film, as opposed to being any more than skin deep.
And is that an easy thing for us to identify, or is there any way for lay people to be able to see that in others?
Yeah, but of course, you know, it's incredibly dangerous. And I've had so many, I see my book, I see The Psychopath Test as a cautionary tale, where I sort of take people into the world of the power-crazed psychopath spotter and then take them out again by pointing out that actually it's difficult and morally dangerous. You know, being a psychopath spotter can turn you a little bit psychopathic. So obviously it's a really dangerous hobby. Yet, yeah, I think you can spot certain things. You know, the weird thing about human nature is that when our brains go wrong, they go wrong in uncannily similar ways. Classic example of that is OCD, where, you know, it's basically the same rituals all over the world. And I think psychopathy is another example of that, that it's obviously it's the opposite. I mean, literally psychopathy is the opposite to OCD, because OCD is an anxiety disorder and psychopathy is an absence of anxiety disorder, you could say. But weirdly, it's kind of similar, that they use similar turns of phrase, they behave in similar ways, and you can find ways to, you know, you can notice it if you know how to.
I'm wondering about whether psychopathy seems to be a sort of a long or short term thing. Obviously, it can be both, but you know, typically when I think of psychopaths, and like maybe when the public does, it tends to be in the sort of this glorified Baroque context. If you know, we think of serial killers, whatever else. But in the case of serial killers are by definition successful, because they've been successful in eluding capture in order to kill, you know, several people in some cases, you know, a dozen or more. And so by definition, if you're a serial killer, you've gotten away with it a certain number of times. But if you're a psychopath, you may or may not have been, you know, fooling people and basically leaving a trail of yeah, victims for, you know, months or years or decades. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one great tool that they have is the fact that they sort of use our liberal sensibilities, that we just don't believe that other people aren't quite like us. And so they tend to get away with an awful lot of stuff because we just can't imagine that people have motives that are completely different to ours, I think, on a sort of everyday office type basis. Mm-hmm. Also, you've got the problem that capitalism at its most remorseless tends to reward psychopathic behavior. So we tend to make them our leaders. So we're sort of dazzled by them, and so we make them our leaders. Am I answering the question right here?
Yeah. I was just curious in terms of, again, the notion that, you know, for example, you might just encounter someone who is just sort of a temporary psychopath, who isn't, you know, a hardcore at their fundamental level psychopath, but they do exhibit psychopathic tendencies now and then, versus somebody who, for 30 or 40 years in the example you gave as we opened up, who manipulated someone into believing that, you know, they had this double life of a CIA operative.
Sure. Well, clinically speaking, there really isn't such thing as a temporary psychopath. You are one from the age of 10 to the day you die, which, again, right, sounds incredibly nihilistic. And the reason why I say the age of 10 is because, you know, one of the items on the checklist is early behavior problems, which is, you know, extreme bad behavior that starts around the age of 10. You can see, you know, when you start bringing kids and children's behavior into it, again, it becomes open to like incredible abuse because kids go through all sorts of stuff, as we all know. However, it tends to always start around the age of 10. So there's no such thing as a temporary psychopath, but there's every such thing as a psychopath who can go through life without ever hurting somebody physically. Mm-hmm. Almost every psychopath doesn't become a serial killer. It's a tiny, tiny minority. But Hare would say they are always malevolent. There's no such thing as like a positive psychopath. You know, they'll always be a cheating husband or a terrible boss, you know, and so on. So they can probably go through quite a long time without committing, you know, without doing that much harm. But Hare would say they will always do harm, and they'll do it forever. Again, you can see why this stuff is kind of dangerous sounding, because, you know, this is a monster podcast, and there's a terrible danger in thinking of other human beings as monsters. Mm-hmm. This is a very kind of contradictory thing, because I agree with the checklist, yet I find it's a really morally, you know, difficult area.
So you just touched briefly on the idea that a psychopath might be able to rise high in business. And here in America, and I don't know how this plays out in the UK, there's this big movement to treat corporations as a kind of entity, almost like a human being. Have you given any thought to how corporations themselves, not just the people who run them, but if you treated them as hypothetical humans, how might corporations fare on the psychopath test? Because I'm wondering, like, what percentage of powerful corporations, if not run by psychopaths, might literally be psychopaths?
Yeah, well, I've got to say, it's hard to not look at. I mean, this gets into sort of polemical territory, which I'm always slightly suspicious of. But it is hard to see certain industries as not, you know, as not being like a sort of physical manifestation of psychopathy. For instance, you know, journalism at its worst can be that. It's all about manipulating people for profit, at its worst. You know, the phone hacking scandal that's going on in Britain at the moment and so on. The subprime banking business, when they were deliberately seeking out vulnerable people to ensnare with loans that would keep them enslaved for the rest of their lives. The American healthcare industry strikes me as a really problematic industry. So, wasn't it Mitt Romney who said corporations are people, my friend? The answer, it's like they are. They can be real bastards. At times they can be psychopathic.
So, John, did you talk to many psychopathic killers in your research?
There was Toto, the Haitian death squad leader, and there was a man called Tony, who I write about a lot in the book, who beat somebody almost to death but didn't actually kill him, thankfully. So the answer to that is sort of.
So they don't normally have tendencies to kill?
No, I mean, Tony's problem was, and he's one of the main characters in the book, was he's not predatory like a lot of psychopaths are. This is where you get into the kind of nuances, by the way, of the checklist, because one of the items on the checklist is cunning manipulative, and another item on the checklist is impulsivity. And critics of the Hare checklist will say, well, how can you have those two in one checklist? And what Tony was impulsive and with poor behavioral controls. But he would never and has never stalked somebody. You know, he's never kind of coldly plotted. He's much more kind of impulsive. He's a kind of bar fight type guy as opposed to a cold plotter.
I have to say one of the particularly interesting examples from your book is a woman named Rachel North. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about her.
Sure. I mean, this gets to a part of the book which isn't really about psychopathy. It's more about the use of madness in journalism.
But it's such a fascinating story. You have to tell us about it.
Oh, it's an incredible story. She is a friend of mine, and she was on one of the trains on July 7th, which blew up. She was in the same carriage as one of the bombers, and but she was okay, and she became a spokesperson for the July 7th survivors. They were pushing for a public inquiry, and they were meeting in pubs as kind of support group. And she became a spokesperson. And one day she was Googling herself, and she discovered that there was a whole bunch of people talking about how she didn't exist and was in fact a team of MI5 officers who were tasked with spreading disinformation about the truth of July 7th, which was that it was not an inside job. This is a different, it's a different theory, that it was an accidental power surge had knocked out the London Underground. And to cover it up, the Blair government had blamed Islamic militants, which has to say does seem like using a sledgehammer to crack and no one died on the bus. It was fake. It was actors and stuntmen on the bus. Mm-hmm. So Rachel emailed them and said, I do exist, and it's not nice, you know, to be told you don't exist when you've just been blown up on the tube, which they took as more evidence that she didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And the more she tried to convince them she existed, the more they were convinced that she didn't. And there were like discussions going on about her, like, I bet it ain't real. Somebody said about her, I bet it ain't real. I first heard about Rachel because some 9/11, I accidentally typed my name into Google and inadvertently press search one day and discovered a 9/11 truther site that said John Ronson is just another Rachel North. So I thought, I wonder who Rachel North is, and that's how I found out about her. And yes, we became friends, and she ended up going to a meeting where they were all going to be discussing, you know, the truth behind July 7th, and she stood up and angrily confronted them all and got into a huge fight with them. And the ringleader of the truthers is a guy called David Shaler, who was an MI5 officer, who became a kind of hero to people, you know, to the kind of anti-government left, because he leaked some secrets and had to go on the run. And he kind of cropped up again as the head of the July 7th truther movement. It's an incredible story.
I just thought it was a fascinating story, partly because of the whole conspiracy element, and just the, you know, because the show is ostensibly about monsters, although we bring in a lot of other skepticism and conspiracy and stuff. And I just thought it was such a great example of how you can have someone stand up in front of people saying, "I'm the person you're claiming doesn't exist," and they're like, "I doubt that."
Right? Yeah, exactly. The fact that you tell me you exist is more evidence that you don't exist. It's unbelievable. Exactly. I kind of lost my sense of humor a bit about it after, you know, I've always felt very glad that I wrote them before 9/11, because them is a sort of funny, in some ways quite sweet-natured book about conspiracy theorists. And, you know, when the truther movement started, it turned conspiracy theorists into a much nastier. You know, there was much less room for being kind of humanist about them, I thought.
I enjoyed the book, but it's such a dark topic. So it was nice that there was a little humor mixed in. But yeah. It is a depressing topic.
I mean, Rachel was getting death threats, and her father, who was a country vicar, was getting, you know, weird letters through the door saying, you know, your daughter is a tool of, you know, the Zionist government, and et cetera, et cetera. So they became, you know, this was a woman who'd nearly died, you know, terrible.
So it seems like a psychopathy, like a lot of psychology, represents a spectrum of behaviors. And so in the statistics about how prevalent psychopathy is, it doesn't seem to break out between the physically dangerous psychopath and the manipulative but maybe not going to stab you psychopath. Is there really a distinction there, or is every psychopath dangerous?
Well, I would say every psychopath, yeah, is dangerous because they are always malevolent. They will always cause you trouble. But more often than not, it will be, you know, just nasty as opposed to violent. So they'll screw with your head. They'll manipulate you just for their own, either for their own pleasure or for their own personal gain. But they won't beat you up. I mean, you know, it's quite often a Venn diagram. You know, there's probably an awful lot of paedophiles out there who will never do anything about it because they would feel too much guilt and shame and remorse. And those are the things that kind of keep us on an even keel. It's the paedophiles who are also psychopaths are the ones, you know, who you have to be worried about.
So I was going to ask if there's any correlation between psychopathy and intelligence at all.
You mean...
do they tend to be more highly intelligent? I think with some conditions, people tend to have to be more intelligent, I think, with like bipolarism. But is there a link with intelligence and psychopathy?
You know, I don't think so. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. Because one of the items on the checklist is need for stimulation, proneness to boredom, which implies, you know, that you don't want to. You're certainly not going to be studious. You're not going to be interested in learning that much. And in fact, I remember Hare saying to me that they quite often seem on the surface to have like a kind of great depth of knowledge about many different things, but when you start to question them, it kind of all falls down. And again, it's like it's superficial. Their knowledge is superficial and not deeply held. It's used. It's like a sort of veneer of knowledge, which is basically something that they use to further themselves.
In one of the threads running through all your books, and especially this one, is meeting with different people, not only psychopaths and people with weird ideas and whatever else. And I'm wondering, what's the as a writer and a journalist, what's the line between befriending and interviewing a person and sort of exploiting them for your book? For example, you talk about, you know, the pleasure of getting nutty quotes and wacky situations from your book and your colorful interviews. And, you know, you're meeting these people who are genuinely colorful, weird, strange characters. But at the same time, you know, there must be sort of this weird gray area where you want to encourage them and get their story and tell it sincerely. I mean, not necessarily exploitation, but on the other hand, you also don't necessarily want to encourage the behavior that you're reporting on. So how do you juggle that?
Well, I have to say that the older I get, the easier that gets for me, because I'm so much more aware of my own, you know, colorful eccentricities and irrationalities and so on. And so when I'm with somebody and I am trying to, you know, I am exploring with them some kind of strangeness, I totally feel that we're in it together, you know? The sort of madness of life, we're in it together. And it's fine. And I really feel that. You know, I think probably when I was younger, I was much more like kind of Dr. Livingstone, you know, sort of hacking my way through the jungle. But that was when I was kind of less clever, I suppose. I was less kind of aware of you know, what guides all of us. I was younger, and with it, I was probably a bit more patronizing. Mm-hmm. But but not anymore, and not for a long time. Nowadays, I feel, you know, as I say, I feel like we're in it together. And I'm very open with people. You know, you can tell when you listen to my radio documentaries or my TV documentaries, you know, I don't hold back. It's not like I ask one question, but then write, you know, but then sort of way, you know, I'm very, very open with people in quite a sort of cheerful, you know, in sort of cheerful way. And so people just sort of talk openly, and it's because I don't feel in any way patronizing towards them nowadays. Mm-hmm. I feel like we're all on this sort of, you know, crazy irrational journey together, and exploring the irrationalities is a kind of pleasant thing for us to do together.
Mm-hmm.
And also, by the way, I like to think that my readers feel the same way too. You know, that people don't tend to read my books from a position of superiority. You know, I like to think leaders are all in it together as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to suggest that I got the sense of, you know, exploitation or anything, just from my own experience and as a journalist and doing other things, that, you know, when you're interviewing people who you clearly disagree with, and yet you respect them and you're sincerely trying to understand them and sympathize with them, there's this sort of a weird line where, you know, you're trying to not be deceptive. On the other hand, you don't want to go in there with a hard-nosed, skeptical attitude saying, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, and I totally, totally know what you mean. And you know what? I think the answer to that is the word skepticism, because I am a skeptic. However, when I'm in those situations, unless I'm with somebody who's really horrible, really mean, and I can think of one or two people like that. I mean, Sylvia Brown is one. I was on a psychic cruise with her one time, and she did feel to me, you know, the thing she was doing was so bad. I did feel like a kind of investigative journalism out to expose her. But that's really, really rare. You know, most of the time, my sort of skeptical hat kind of comes off when I'm with people. It sort of regains itself when I'm back at home writing a bit. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure I get things sort of factually right, and I don't go into a sort of postmodern, you know, arena. But when I'm with people, I don't feel, you know, particularly skeptical. I sort of tend to immerse myself in their way of being, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's, you know, that's the best way of being. I mean, you know, I'm a great fan of the skeptical movement, but that's the one part of it that I'm always, you know, that I'm slightly critical of. You know, it can sometimes be slightly dehumanizing of the, you know, the people who we don't agree with. And sometimes that's completely valid and justified, but on other occasions I think it's not.
Well, that's sort of the bigger issue in skepticism, I think, is there's that activist, you know, trying to stop, you know, all medicine that doesn't work, trying to protect against scams. And at the same time, there has to be, hey, this is a really useful worldview. Why don't you try it, right? And if you've got like the I don't know what to call it, the activists who want to change the world by stopping bad things, a complementary sort of group that wants to say, hey, and this is a fun way to live. You know, it's a great thing to sort of be able to have this tool set to evaluate what's real and what's not.
Absolutely. So. But at the same time, try and see it from their perspective. I mean, obviously there's some things which you just can't, you know, scammers and frauds. There are certain people out there there's just no point in trying to see the world from their perspective. But then there's other people. You know, I was in Iowa the other week talking with some people from a church group, and I didn't feel the need to say to them, you know, these sex addiction, gambling addiction, you know, support groups that you have in your church, you know, it's based on a false premise, you know, that I didn't feel the need to say it to them. I sort of thought, okay, you know, if it works for you and if people's lives are better, then that's okay, you know. And so, you know, I guess I'm a little more humanistic about it than some people in the movement, I suppose.
Well, there is that whole, well, again, that's the whole, there's people who are, let's say, atheists who think that religion is bad and should be gotten rid of. And there's people who are atheists by definition, but don't like the word atheist because of all the connotation of anti-religion, which they may be perfectly okay with. So, you know, way off topic from monsters, but yeah. that kind of self-assessment by the skeptical movement, I guess it's one of the reasons why I embrace skepticism over and I think of myself as a positive humanist and a skeptic and don't spend much time working on the atheism agnosticism side of things.
Right. And yeah, a humanist and a skeptic together, I think, is a very good combination. That's the right combination to have.
Well, of course, yeah. You and I think. No. So I actually had a question. Now that you're a little more removed from the book by time, do you still find yourself mentally testing people you encounter for psychopathy?
Yeah, but I'm less, but I'm more self-aware about it now, and I understand the pitfalls of it now. At the same time, you know what? I think it's a kind of positive thing to have. It does solve some mysteries. For instance, I can think of lots of occasions when I've interviewed people over the years where they just haven't answered my questions. It's like I wasn't in the room. And that is a potential sign of psychopathy, because I think interviews are kind of based on empathy. And if you have no empathy, you feel no need to please, you know, the other person that you're talking to. And so there's no need to answer their questions. And quite recently, I was interviewing somebody who just completely ignored all my questions and went off for these, you know, 45-minute answers. And I thought to myself, God, you know, this guy is incredibly annoying. And I sort of remembered what Robert Hare said about that. So I started asking him questions about his childhood. I said, you know, what kind of kid were you? Were you a bully? And he said, yes, I was. I was a terrible bully. I used to jump up from behind the tree and hit people with a brick. And I said, and did you enjoy it? I said, how did you feel about it? He said, I felt good. And I said, and now looking back on it, because he was like 70, I said, how do you feel now looking back on it? And he said, yeah, I still feel good. So there's an example of, you know, using my psychopath. I'm not going to do anything with that, but it was a solution to the mystery of why was that guy behaving in the way that he was.
Well, final question time. We always like to ask our guests what their favorite monster is. So, John, what's your favorite monster?
Ooh. I guess Thor doesn't count as a monster, does he?
Sure.
Wait, are you
ninjas as monsters? So I think
are you frightened by Thor?
No, I admire Thor. I only chose Thor because we sat down and watched the movie the other day, and I thought it was fantastic. So Thor is at the topmost of my mind. But I guess Thor is a bad answer. Okay, who's?
Well, no, you could do Thor if you want to. Did you not find Loki a bit repulsive?
Yeah, no, you're right. Loki was
a there were some frost giants in that movie. It's the Hemsworth. It's the all those abs. It just takes over your mind, and then.
And you know what? I've just decided who my favorite monster is. I've come up with a better monster. My favorite monster is Jeffrey Tambor. Because Hank Kingsley is the best ever television monster.
Fair enough.
And also, I was listening to a Marin podcast the other day, and that guy from Scott Pilgrim was on. I've forgotten his name. Michael Cera. Mm-hmm. Michael Cera was on.
Yeah.
And he told a story about how when he was in Arrested Development, he was there with his mother on the first day's shooting. And Jeffrey Tambor walked past, and Michael Cera said, "Oh, Jeffrey, come and meet my mother." And Jeffrey Tambor said, "I don't want to meet your f***ing mother." And then carried on walking, and then turned around and came back and gave her a kiss. So he was kidding with her. But I just thought that is one great monster. So Jeffrey Tambor is my favorite monster.
Plus, of course, he was in Max Headroom, so he gets extra points.
I didn't even know he was in Max Headroom.
He was.
Oh, wow. That's very cool.
Ben would know. Thank you so much for spending an hour with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. I'm very happy to have done it. Okay, cool. It was good talking with you guys.
Thanks.
Good talking to you, John. Thanks.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. I'm Blake Smith, and in this episode, together with Karen Stolzno and Ben Radford, We've been talking to author John Ronson about his book, The Psychopath Test. A link to Ronson's book is in the show notes. Thanks again to everyone who's been helping out with our transcript project. If you'd like to contribute to that work, a link to the PayPal button as well as contact information for your hosts in all of their social media guises is in the show notes at monstertalk.org. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed on this show are that of the host and the guest and do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
Hang on one second, because the plumbers are at my door. Just hang on a sec.
He means his MI5 controllers.
Yeah.